We are blessed with an abundance of cheap food, at least so they say, but others say the ways in which food have been made cheap have cheapened the food and degraded the land in which it was grown. And so we ask, can we grow nourishing food that restores the land?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,163rd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Limassol who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, I ran across the following in Gary Nabhan's new book, Food from the Radical Center. Please give a listen. As a cub reporter for Environmental Action, I covered everything from lead poisoning of children in Rust Belt factory towns to pesticide effects on birds and bees in Midwest farmlands. At the time, I sincerely believed that issues of environmental health would unite Americans, transcending lines of race and class. We would be galvanized by our desire to see both the government and industry get on with doing the right thing. Now, I personally wasn't exactly sure what that right thing would be. Well, folks, today, with that thought in mind, I propose that we all come to an agreement on the fact that doing the right thing is growing food that nourishes the body and heals the earth. All agreed? Good. So now we have to ask, how do we grow food that nourishes the body and heals the earth? And who better to ask than Gary Nabhan himself? He is the author of Food from the Radical Center. Gary, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Oh, it's great to be with you again, Michael.
So, you know, over the last decade, by the way, folks, Gary is an ethnobiologist and an agroecologist at the University of Arizona. Still there, right, Gary?
That's right.
Okay, good. Well, Gary, over the last decade, you and I have had food chain discussions about the Soviet Union's Nikolai Vavilov and Trofim Lysenko, the Amish farmers of the Midwest, the food caravans of the spice trade, and farming through history's great droughts. And so here we have arrived at Food from the Radical Center. And I got to, the title of your book, of course, just floored me because where the hell is the center these days? It seems like, you know, we have become such a polarized body politic that there's no center left.
Well, that's right. We're amused by that very condition in Arizona where all of a sudden the late John McCain and Jeff Flake now seem to be our moderates in the world and our voices of reason. And we're proud of the things that they've gotten right. But the radical center term is actually an old one. And it is something that came into the agricultural discussion through a rancher named Bill McDonald, who was one of the founders of the Malpai Borderlands Group. And he said, if environmentalists and conservative ranchers would just walk into the center toward each other, we'd be in a much more radical place for change than if we took our hardline stances against one another and try to find some middle ground. And now farmers in your area are part of another discussion called the Middle Path, which is doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I also think Joel Salatin out in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia was talking about the same thing. If you could just get these hard-headed farmers and ranchers to think about how environmental they really are, maybe we could get somewhere.
And exactly the same with hard-headed environmentalists.
Same thing,
I have been much of my life. And so I'm in no position of privilege or superior and enlightened stances for most of my life. I'm just very engaged now in fostering these conversations that bring us together rather than further divide us.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that struck me about your writing, Gary, is that, you know, through the years, we've talked a lot about the stories you have told, and I always thought, you know, a remarkable storyteller. But here you're holding something up, and you're actually becoming a campaigner, a jihadist, if you will. Am I wrong?
Well, that's a great thing. I want us to return to dialogue, and I'm willing to go out on the road. I've just been 8 days out on the road saying, America's been more divided in the last 2 years and any time since the Civil War. And even if each of us had a magic wand and could get who he wanted in for president, for the Senate, and for the Supreme Court, we'd still be a divided country. I think what farming and ecological restoration and caretaking of our land and our elders and our children can bring us back to is the things that most of us commonly value.
Yeah, there it is. You told an excellent story about a lady who gave a lecture, a 20-minute lecture, you said, and in the middle of that lecture, she stepped out and transformed herself. Could you tell that story? Because I think it really does an excellent example of telling about what the radical center might be.
Well, thank you. I think it's one of the pivotal points in my life, and that I have tried to track down this woman's name. She was a real performance artist and moral voice, and been unable to. Saddens me, but let me just go ahead and tell the story. I was at a ecological restoration meeting in the Northwest right after President Clinton and Forest Service Director Jack Ward Thomas closed down logging in an area the size of four Connecticuts. And all the environmentalists were extremely enthused that their work could go on and that we might save some species like the spotted owl in the Northwest. And in the middle of a session on those topics, a woman came up to the microphone to give her 20-minute talk, who was dressed in a sort of Western-style pantsuit. She had a little bit of a rural country accent. Her hair was perfectly coiffed. And I noticed in the room that people were just dismissing her. Most of the people around me had on Tevas, T-shirts that had slogans like Save the Salmon, Spawn Until You Die. They wore chums around their neck with their sunglasses and were already on their computers doing other things by the time she started to talk. And a few minutes into the talk, she said, could you just sit in your seats for 2 minutes, I have to go to the bathroom. I'll be back in a second. I'm embarrassed to say this, but just let me go and please stay here. She came back dressed exactly like most of us in that room and said, I think you all were dismissing me for superficial reasons, but I want to tell you about my husband and our friends who lost their jobs as loggers who are now restoring salmon streams. And I think you need to know about their work, and we need to know about yours if we're going to have an economy that not only heals the land, but creates jobs. And I want you to stay with me for the next few minutes and listen to this great work that former loggers are doing to restore the salmon streams that you all have fought for. And I was humbled that I was as caught off guard, as vulnerable to presumptions and prejudices on the basis of someone's dress and accent as anyone else in that room. And it was a life-changing moment for me.
There, right before your eyes, was a transformation. And it is a way of transforming you as well.
That's right. And I feel I've been sort of on a slow metamorphosis ever since to embrace in a more inclusive way the many voices, particularly in the western states where the rancor from the Malheur Wildlife Refuge to the desecration of sacred lands in Indian country has been going on for decades, and that we've had deep social divisions over those environmental issues.
Yes, and hopefully we'll figure out how to find that radical center and pull this all together. That is the subject today, is how do we go about growing food that nourishes the body and heals the earth? We have with us Gary Nabhan, an author, one of my favorite characters, a storyteller, a wonderful stories, and we've had some great conversations through the years, everything from Vavilov Lysenko to the spice trades. I've traveled the world with you, Gary. This time we're looking for the radical center, and can we find it? We certainly hope we can. We need it. When we come back, Gary, I'm going to ask the big question, which is always asked. Hey, we can't grow food like this. We have to adopt the industrial model to feed the world. Otherwise, we're all going to starve. So I'm going to ask you, do we need to farm that industrial way to save the world? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these important messages.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. Ah, you can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
And now, back to What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, is it possible to grow food that really nourishes the body, not just fills up the belly, but nourishes the body and heal the earth? I think so. Gary Nabhan have found a number of people that have, and I certainly have as well through the years. They're out there. And so we have to hold them up and learn from them. But those critics of that ecological way of farming always point to the need for industrial agriculture and say, if we don't do it this way, we'll all starve. Gary, what say you?
Well, I'm persuaded by some of the farmers that I've heard over the years at Eco Farm, right down the road from you, like Gabe Brown from the Dakotas, a stockman, who points out that the loss of soil in the United States has meant that we now would have to eat 4 to 8 times the volume of certain fruits and vegetables to get the same amount of nutrients we got from those plants in the early 20th century. What he's saying is that the industrial agricultural model that's depleted that soil is not going to feed us what we really need unless we reinvest in that landscape, in soil health and in pollinator health and many of the other things that you and I have spoke to over the years. But at another level, I also don't want to disparage people who are not organic farmers who we need to adopt some of these great practices that innovators in the organic movement have come up with. What I'm saying is that they're going to have to transition, forced economically or by other pressures, to be more energy and water efficient in their agriculture. And we need to support them in that transition, just as I'm saying I've had to go through a transition in my own thinking about these issues. Mm-hmm. So we lose nothing by we gain nothing by disparaging conventional agriculturalists, and that's what this middle path movement is about on the West Coast, that's bringing organic and conventional farmers together to find common ground.
Well, good. And with respect to many of the people that you found out there who are doing what you say would be the right thing, one of that really caught my attention was your segment on bringing back the bison. And the reason that caught my attention, because some years ago I did a food chain radio show from the Pine Ridge Reservation out there in the Dakotas. I was going to host the person responsible for the Great Sioux Buffalo herd and the bringing back of that herd. And I was waiting for him we were going to rendezvous at a convenience store there on the reservation. Of course, there was no beer or anything in the store, but there were all of the other things that convenience stores have, and I was hungry, and I was looking for something to eat. It's not the easiest thing to do to find something to eat in a convenience store if you think about what's in the food at all. So I kind of gravitated toward the jerky section, and I was standing there staring at the jerky, and I realized that all of the jerky in that Sioux Reservation convenience store was from cattle processed in Los Angeles. And I thought, help these people come to grips with, I just think of they should be selling Sioux buffalo jerky in Los Angeles. And if you want to restore the Great Sioux herd, boy, that would be a great place to start. You found another place that's starting out there in Texas, correct?
That's right. And I should say that even a similar event happened to me. I was in discussion with Winona LaDuke, one of the great Native American leaders of our time, and she was on her way to an American Indian agriculture meeting in Las Vegas, of all places. And
well, it's a good place to have a meeting, right?
Right. And she noticed that one of the sponsors of the meeting, of the Intertribal Agricultural Council, was a company that was branding Native American beef jerky, not even bison jerky, and none of it was being processed in the United States on a reservation. And she spoke up at the meeting about that and put that one to rest, you know. Mm-hmm. And the point is that these contradictions and discrepancies are all around us, and you're wise to point them out. But there's a remarkable cross-cultural collaboration that's brought back the bison, not just in the Great Plains where it used to be, but all the way across the country, of course, because there were woodland bison too. And more than 30 indigenous nations in Canada and the United States are involved in that effort, but they're also very open to exchanging animals with other bison ranchers that are not of Native American descent to make sure that the herds are healthy and that the land is healthy. So they're moving away from feedlot production of bison to grass-fed bison on large tracts of reservations. And I think it's a very positive story of cross-cultural collaboration that's led from 500 bison left a little more than a century ago to over 8 million out on the range today.
Yeah, and those bison were collected way back when by Charlie Goodnight, right?
Charlie Goodnight saved the southern bison herd that my friend Hugh at Shape Ranch in Texas is now managing some of the genetics from that herd. So it's a real success story of bringing something back from the brink of extinction. And I just want to say that it was ranchers and farmers and Native American leaders, not the federal government, that's done most of that work.
Well, I think it's probably true with just about everything you can when it comes to think about it. But as I understand it, there are only a very limited number. I think, three herds of real, true bison? Most all of the rest of the bison in the United States are crossbred with cows, right? Cattle.
You're correct on that scientific point that very few of the herds left are without cattle genes. But ironically, that's what may have saved the herds from completely dying of diseases like
brucellosis.
Yes, because the cow genes from chance hybridization in the 1880s, 1890s gave those survivors some resistance. And now in some of the herds, probably the cattle genes are only 1 or 2% of the overall genetics. But you're right. There's hardly any purebred bison left, and that helped them get through this bottleneck as the overhunting and the diseases were decimating the herds.
Will the reservations throughout the Midwest and West have enough grasslands to support herds of bison?
Well, certainly in the northern plains, the Dakotas and Wyoming and Montana, they're being produced on larger and larger tracts where ranchers, both Native American and Anglo, including Canadian ranchers, have taken the fences down. So I won't hazard a guess of how the ratio of bison to cattle will change over the next 50 years, but it's going the right way. Bison is clearly economic. People who are engaged in it are usually real innovators. And so I think that trend is going in the right direction.
You know, I was just back in Virginia last week and noticed that all the restaurants there were serving bison. And I thought, that is interesting and perhaps a good sign, because if people are buying it, maybe there will be a reason for them to live. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Might right back with our good friend Gary Nabhan and you.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back with the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Gary Nabhan, author of Food from the Radical Center. Question of the day, can we grow food that nourishes the body and heals the land at the same time? Gary's found a few people who are doing that across the land. We talked about buffalo. I'd like to talk about fish. Give me a fish and I will eat today. Teach me to fish, I will eat always. Gary, you're out there in the Delaware River country. Pretty interesting landscape, right?
Well, yes. I was in the midst of the Rust Belt factory rows along the rivers of the Northeast, searching for Atlantic sturgeon, what was one of the most abundant and widely eaten fish on the eastern seaboard, and yet I found myself in rivers where probably fewer than 500 individuals of that Atlantic salmon species happened to survive, but I saw a tremendous effort to bring them and their habitats back.
What are we doing to rescue the rivers of the industrial Midwest? And you know, if you think about it, the time in which those factories were put in place was probably a time in American history that's kind of analogous to what China has been going through over the last couple decades. Let's grow. Let's do anything we must do to grow. Let's build factories. Let's throw the stuff in the river. To heck with it. Who cares? Let's get the money. It's probably what we were doing back then, right?
That's right. And people were concerned about the industrial revolution's effect on fish even a century ago. So as you're saying, this isn't a new issue. I was born and grew up in the Indiana Dunes, and the U.S. steel mills nearby there were the same story, really, that an incredible abundance of fish and many different species were depleted over our lifetimes and the generation before us, and now it's taking an enormously costly effort to recover them. But back in the Delaware and Schuylkill River, tens of thousands of people are involved in river cleanup, and farmers on the lands above the river are involved in keeping nitrates and other agricultural chemicals from flowing into the rivers and contaminating the river bottoms that the Atlantic salmon frequent. So it's been a daunting task, but maybe 40,000 people are involved in some way every month in doing actions there. That
40,000 people?
Restore their watershed. Yes, hundreds of little land trusts and farmers' organizations, as well as fisheries biologists who are actually doing the monitoring and recovery work for the sturgeon themselves. But if you look at the watershed-wide effort back between the Hudson and the Delaware, it's an enormous effort that many rural and urban producers are engaged in.
What is the organizing principle behind such an effort? I mean, somebody or some organization must stand there and say, you know, provide a clearinghouse or some kind of organizing principle for this.
Right. So there's actually a remarkable set of overlapping networks of river keepers and conservation groups and also fish enthusiasts who are working together on this. The William Penn Foundation chose to make this one of their top priorities, not only for fish health, but for human health. Of course, all the people living in the shadows of those 19th century factories are facing a lot of toxins in their water supply and all that. And even you can't simply dredge the bottoms of those rivers and remove the toxins, that stirs them up in the water. So, as I said, it's a daunting task, but the people power put into making that river alive and diverse again really humbled me, because sometimes the industrial contamination just overwhelms me so much that I say, that's not part of my environmentalism. I don't even have the energy to go there. And yet so many people are part of it that you have to be grateful for their efforts.
You talk a lot about the food deserts of those factory farm or those factory settings and how they used to be rich farmlands and have pretty much turned into food deserts in those factory cities.
I was struck by that fact about 20, 25 miles north of Philadelphia, where I went back with 19th century natural histories in my hands, the places where the Atlantic sturgeon were most abundant and were even sort of kept in pastures. aquatic pastures in the river with fences around them, and now you wouldn't want to eat anything, aquatic plant or fruit growing on the side of the river, because of the amount of contamination. And it's the kind of thing that really takes a toll on human health as well. So we have this incredible irony that these remarkably rich aquatic faunas that were all the way across North America, but had populations so large that they almost defy counting and defy description.
Kind of like the buffalo on the Great Plains.
That's right. In fact, the sturgeon were called the buffalo of Albany, the Albany buffalo or Hudson buffalo, because the fish were the size of the front seat of your car, and and people could walk across the fish when they were migrating without dipping past their ankles in the water. So this was a remarkable abundance, and that people have the tenacity and the drive to try to take on such a large task just humbled me.
Well, that they are taking on the task is one thing, but are they showing some signs of actually achieving the task?
Well, I was pretty stunned that I was able to hold two little fledgling Atlantic sturgeon in my hands at a place where their numbers had gone up tenfold just over the last few years. That I was only back there for a few days, but my first day out on the water, that we actually live netted some fish and measured them and re-released them into the water, just amazed me. And so they think that the numbers may be 20 to 50 times higher than what they were when this fish was first listed. Now, there's still some problems. A critical habitat for the fish has not been formalized in a way that makes a concrete contribution to their recovery, and some of the pollution goes on, and some of the dredging goes on, and dredging, of course,
stirs up the muck.
That's right.
But you have 40,000 people working on it, and who knows what kind of ingenuity they can bring to bear on the restoration of a river, and perhaps maybe sometime in the future, turning that river into a food source for people. And so people can eat, and in doing so, have good reason to take care of that river. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Food from the Radical Center with Gary Nabum and you, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in with Gary Nabum, author of The Food from the Radical Center. Love the idea. I love the presentation that little lady made in that little anonymous lady made in the seminar when she came in dressed as a logger's wife and excused herself and went to the restroom and came back dressed as a hippie and said, I'm still the same person, and we're doing the same thing. And it really is the Radical Center, is it not, Gary?
I think many of our neighbors and friends are already part of this, and it's not something that will happen. It is happening.
How can we make it really happen? What can all of us out here do to pour some coals on the fire?
Well, I need to start with the very basic gesture, which is empathy. That when farmers are having trouble, we need to understand why they feel they're in trouble. And the same thing, farmers need to hear what consumers' needs are. It's no longer possible for a farmer to say, oh, you have gluten allergies, and you're boycotting my products. I don't like you. The best farmers are showing empathy with those people. So some of the great grain products and oldest organic grain distributors are now making gluten-free products for consumers who need those because of their health issues. So what I think is we begin with empathy, we put aside our ideologies, and then we start to work on policies and practices that we all benefit from. For instance, we have maybe 800 million acres of farm in soybeans right now that these tariffs imposed by the Chinese government to counter Trump's tariffs will affect in the next year. We don't want all those farmers to go bankrupt because they've just lost their market. But at the same time, we know that soy has played a major role in the decline of monarch butterflies because most soybean farmers, I think 80%, are using either Roundup or dicamba
or both
resistant herbicides or both. Can we help those farmers transition to herbicide-free agriculture and plant pollinator plants on their adjacent lands that may now go abandoned instead of saying, well, they chose that route, tough luck, we don't care about them. In other words, we have a tremendous opportunity in the next few years as soybean acreage declines to come up with an alternative that keeps those farmers in business but also brings back the monarch populations that have dwindled to 5% of what they were 20 years
ago. Well, Gary, I vote for bison. Let's plant some grass and turn those soybeans into bison territory. Gary Nabin, we're out of time, but what fun it is to have a conversation with you. Always have fun with you. And so what's next?
Well, I just have to say you're the best in the country in terms of these interviews and keeping the discussions going at the community level. So thank you, Michael, for your career full of great interviews and great work. And I just have to say I'll be at Stanford and Point Reyes Books and the Book Passage on the West Coast in the next week and look forward to meeting some of your listeners.
There you go. Thank you, Gary, and thank you all for tuning in. Hey, remember, Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
Great. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.